and welcome to Worlds Apart. As an old English euphemism goes, all is fair in love and war. And it's not just a cheeky phrase. At close consideration, falling in love and fighting a war have a lot in common. Passion, obstinacy, hurt feelings, irrational waste of resources, and a strong desire to hurt your opponent. Perhaps then ending a war is also in some ways similar to finishing an ill-fated romance. What would it take in the case of the conflict in Ukraine? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Michael Rossi, lecturer in political science at Rutgers University and visiting professor in the Department of International Relations at Webster University in Tashkent. Professor Rossi, it's great to see you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me on, and thank you for asking me what we're about to talk about today.
Well, we are about to talk about primarily the conflict in Ukraine and perhaps the implications it has both for regional politics and for global politics. But I want to start with a very concrete development. You wrote recently that Ukraine's attack on Russia's Kursk region was an attempt to show the world that Ukraine can still hurt its neighbor and humiliate Vladimir Putin and Russia's military command. And I want to ask you, why do you think this demonstration of the ability to cause damage is in Ukraine's interests?
The very quick and concise answer to that is because Ukraine still needs to be seen as relevant, right? Beyond just simple, repetitive Western talking points, right? Ukraine needs to remain in the news. They need to show that they're capable of fighting despite the weeks and months of setbacks. They need to convince their Western sponsors that sending weapons, ammunition, lending diplomatic support, and realizing that Ukraine's membership, potential membership in NATO, is the most fought after membership, is something that the West should still take seriously and invest in. The ability of Ukraine to stage this attack within Russian territory and still hold on to a large piece of that territory now for the last few weeks does a couple of things. One, it shows that Ukraine is not yet ready to give up. Number two, Russia is vulnerable, even though it's a small incursion. Many people who were thinking that a Russian counterattack could easily push Ukrainian forces back within just a few days were proven wrong. And, you know, it was a gamble. It was a gamble largely to see if Putin would pull some of his forces from other parts of Ukraine back into Russia to counteract this incursion and thus relieve some of the Ukrainian forces within the eastern and southern Donbas regions.
Well, you mentioned it was a staged gamble, but the question is whether it is ultimately in Ukraine's interest, because the ability to hurt is certainly a valuable geopolitical asset, but it needs to be more or less precise. I mean, it needs to be painful for the opponent. It needs to be at a relatively low cost for a power that causes it. Do you think Ukraine is capable of delivering just that, you know, hurting Russia, but not at a huge cost for itself?
Well, I mean, that was pretty much proven within the first 48 to 72 hours. If the larger goal was to reach Kursk, or, you know, more specifically, to reach the Kursk nuclear power plant, that didn't happen. So, you know, it was a gamble, which is now becoming abundantly clear was a miscalculated gamble. So what they are now doing is entrenching themselves in the territory around the border town of Sudzha. And by the videos that we see coming out, it's not much of an occupation force as it is a mercenary raid, just simply looting supermarkets, terrorizing the local population, with maybe the hope that this would create some kind of public backlash in Russia that Putin isn't doing enough to defend his own territory. But in the, in the larger grand scheme of things, I mean, if at absolute best, this would have been a paper cut against the larger Russian infrastructural and military arsenal. And, you know, the Telegram stories that are coming out and, you know, most of the primary source material that we get on the spot are from, you know, the numerous Telegram channels, take them, you know, however way that you want, is that this was, a heavily debated decision within the Kiev political and military elite as to whether this was going to do anything other than just create a temporary distraction.
Well, maybe a temporary distraction is good enough for the PR-oriented Ukrainian leadership. But you said before that Ukraine now is trying very hard to sort of keep its relevancy vital, its relevancy in the eyes of Washington decision makers. What place do you think the Kiev authorities want to occupy within the U.S. orbit, and how realistic is that?
Well, we have to remember that there is an election coming up, a presidential election, which widely is understood to be, if Donald Trump wins, the United States is going to largely disengage from the Ukrainian scene, focus more on what's happening now in the Middle East. Trump has made certainly a lot of noise saying that he would try to negotiate a ceasefire, a peace agreement between Ukraine and Russia. This, take it as you will, is certainly seen with certain problems within Kiev. If Kamala Harris wins, it's business as usual, just continuing the policies of the Biden administration. It really is, considering what has not only been going on in Gaza for almost a year, but now that there is what it seems to be a new war, a new front opening up in Israel against Lebanon, Ukraine is risking being relegated to the back pages of international news. The Ukraine war seems to be really bogged down in what is becoming a frozen conflict. There are many elites and analysts within Europe that are considering brokering some kind of ceasefire, even to the point of, you know, both sides just kind of holding on to whatever battle lines that they have. Ukraine does not want this. Russia does not want, the United States does not want this, because it just gives both sides time to regroup and refresh. Kiev does not want this because the frozen conflict effectively means the loss of the four territories plus Crimea. So if anything, it shows that Ukraine still has a fighting spirit, that they are willing to go the extra mile to not only defend their own territory, but take the war onto Russia's side and show the West that they are not as fatigued or as demoralized as many people assume them to be.
Now, I'm sure you heard me quote this 16th century phrase in the beginning of the program, that all is fair in love and war. And I find it strangely fitting for Ukraine, which threw itself wholeheartedly, almost recklessly, into this indirect geopolitical clash between Russia and the West, sacrificing a lot, not only in terms of lives, but also in terms of material resources, but so far not gaining much. And that's not a very typical behavior for a nation state, certainly not a very practical one. How do you understand the logic of it?
I mean, all is fair in love and war, but when you lose the war and you're the political elite, you've got a plane waiting to take you out of the country with all of your assets, your family, and your money. Those who wage war in this manner and lose will certainly have an exit strategy and won't think twice about the country that they devastate. I mean, Ukraine is really caught between a proxy conflict between the United States and NATO on one side, and Russia on the other.
Professor Rossi, it's not just caught. It threw itself eagerly into it.
The political elite in Kiev ever since 2014, right, has been wedded to the belief that their future belongs in Europe, in NATO, away from Russia, at the direct expense of current Ukrainian, Russian diplomatic, economic, and infrastructural ties. Right. It is a major decision to be made, and it's one that is going to come with significant costs. Whether they predicted the war that is happening right now, is really something that only they can and only they can say. But knowing that there are a number of elites within Ukraine who somehow believed that the West had their best intentions, is either that they know something that the rest of us don't know, or they were unbelievably hopeful, even to the point of being naive.
Professor Rossi, I find it helpful to add psychological lenses to geopolitical discussions. And in personal psychology, there is a clear link between romanticized passions, grandiose ideas, magical thinking on the one hand, and narcissism and codependency on the other. And I wonder if that could be extended to national behaviors too, particularly the behavior of Ukraine, that relatively young nations would be susceptible to the pitfalls of political idealization and devaluing and sort of instinctively look for geopolitical sugar daddies.
Well, whether that is Washington or Brussels is something that we can...
Well, maybe both. I mean, Ukraine is liberally minded, so I don't think it needs, you know, just one partner. It may avail of many of them, I suppose.
Mostly, I mean, you know, the thing with Ukraine is, and, you know, this was mentioned almost 30 years ago by Sam Huntington in his book, Clash of Civilizations. It's not a book that I'm a fan of, but I was just rereading it again, just leafing through some of the chapters a few weeks ago. And he devoted a significant section to Ukraine. Now, mind you, he's writing in the 1990s. And he referred to Ukraine as what we call a cleft country, right? In which you have really the fault lines between two different cultural proclivities. Western Ukraine looks towards Europe, Eastern Ukraine looks towards Russia. And the goal of any political government in Kiev is to find a balance between the two of them. Considering that the European Union has now expanded to include nearly all of the countries of the former Eastern Europe communist bloc, and the border of the EU and NATO is right there at the Western Ukrainian border, those that are in Western Ukraine, as I like to say in my classes, can look out of their window on a clear day and see Europe. It's right there. So where does the border between Europe and the rest lie? Is it at the Polish-Ukrainian border? Does it include Ukraine? We certainly know from EU officials, it does not include Russia as well as NATO. But the Baltics, that's okay. Georgia, that's fine. Moldova, that's fine. Ukraine, that's fine. So it gives a number of political, economic, and intellectual elites in Ukraine some sense that if they really push for this, they can get it. And if they get some kind of assurance from Brussels, whether it's the EU or NATO, or London or Berlin or Paris or Washington, then it's something worth fighting for. And, you know, more to the point is that most of the post-Soviet countries, the Baltics in particular, at least two of the three Caucasus countries, Ukraine, Moldova, among others, even there's a few elites here within Central Asia, right? Their goal in leaving the Soviet sphere, in leaving the post-Soviet legacy, is to gravitate towards whatever is new. And so for a country like Ukraine, with its pro-Western leadership, that's the future.
Professor Rossi, let's stop here because I think this is a very interesting subject to look closer into. But for the time being, we have to take a very short break, and we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is also absurd.
This is third world lunacy.
Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are we living on, man?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Ми обычно їдемо куди?
бойцам нашим на позиции.
Война – это вообще такое благодатное место для того, чтобы понять, кто ты в этой жизни. Что нужно делать, чтобы остаться человеком? Чем пожертвовать ради этого?
Мама дала мне молитву свою рукописную. Она написала ее от руки. Молитва всегда со мной. Она написана башкирским языком, но здесь текст арабский. Альхамду лиллахи раббил галамин. Ну, она такая, мусульманская. Я эту молитву распечатал, скажем так, в большом количестве для своих ребят и раздал, как я это вижу, это работа.
Мне кажется, у нас такой тандем сложился с Хазратом, шикарный просто. Вот сейчас мы должны быть вместе. Сейчас мы должны искать не то, что вот нас разведет в сторону, а то, что нас объединит в одно целое.
Хочется, конечно, повидаться со всеми бойцами, почитать со всеми за здравие бойцов, за сохранность их жизни.
Как выстроен даже мусульманин, христианин. Мусульманин, христианин. Мусульманин, христианин. Слава Богу. Хамдилля.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Michael Rossi, lecturer in political science at Rutgers University and visiting professor in the Department of International Relations at Webster University in Tashkent. Now, Professor Rossi, before the break, you described this, mindset among some of former Soviet republics that sort of Russia or the Soviet legacy is the past, the European Union or association with the West is the future, but countries and governments have to live in the present, not in the past or in the future, but in the present. And it's in the present that they have to trade with their neighbors, to collect taxes, to build roads, to run schools and hospitals. And, you know, these very basic necessities of life, they tend to make politics a little bit more grounded. But it seems that Ukraine was so infatuated with this glorious vision of the future that, the cost of getting there somehow escaped it, because it's very hard for me to believe that the Ukrainian officials would not anticipate some sort of reaction from Russia, because they lived with Russia side by side. They have all this narrative of how abusive Russia has been towards them historically. So they are supposed to have genetic memories of how Russia conducts its foreign policy. How did it escape them?
That's an unbelievably good question, because knowing that there is within this mindset a healthy dosage of what Glenn Deason refers to as Russophobia, and that isn't just simply racism and xenophobia against the Russian people, but this this set of assumptions, presumptions, right, that Russia is this autocratic behemoth, this Eurasian behemoth, that is not going to just simply suffer being pushed to the sidelines, right? There's going to be some kind of response from them. So the only thing that I could say as far as the Ukrainian political, and we have to be very careful about who we're mean when we're talking about Ukrainian political elites. You can't lump them all together. There are plenty of Ukrainian political leaders and parties, at least up until 2022, that were pro-Ukrainian, but were very pragmatic in dealing with Russia, in not severing ties and trying to find a balance, right, between the West and Russia, because that was what Ukraine's strength was, a bridge between Europe and the
absolutely
rest.
And it's the pattern that, or the strategy that many in between countries are pursuing, for example, Turkey and many others. They are actually getting the benefit from this clash rather than sacrificing everything to be in the middle of it.
Yes, but note that some countries like Turkey can get away with it because Turkey is larger and it's still seen as much more strategic to NATO, as well as its position within the Mediterranean. Ukraine, on the other hand, is, at least since 2014, has been given, unfortunately, the same degree of take-it-or-leave-it scrutiny that smaller countries like Georgia, Moldova, and Serbia, we have to remember Serbia, ever since 2000, has been pressured to say you cannot sit on more than one chair. You cannot sit on two chairs, Serbia. You cannot be Europe and Russia. And this is now a big problem when it comes to the disputed territory of Kosovo, which I need to emphasize is support there. Its independence, its unilateral independence is supported by the very same powers in the West that insist that only a return to the 1991 borders with Ukraine will be an acceptable peace solution. So the double standards that are coming from the West towards Serbia, towards Ukraine, among others, right, is seen, right? It's visibly seen, which is why we're having these conversations. The Ukrainian elite that have put all of their hope and future within this take it or leave it, West is best and the rest is nothing, as I said, may be the ones to leave the country, may be the ones as soon as they're about to, you know, be thrown out of power to find an exit strategy.
Absolutely. But while the country remains in rubble, essentially. Now, I know that one of your interests, academic interests, is the connection between culture and politics. And yes. I want to throw in a sort of a personal question, because I'm a Russian of Ukrainian descent. And I think what Americans perhaps don't appreciate enough about the Ukrainian culture or Ukrainian collective psyche is the degree of vengeance, because historically the Ukrainians have had the habit of falling out of love just as quickly as falling into it. Do you think this echo of Ukrainian vengeance will ever reach American shores? Does Washington have reasons to worry about Ukraine's ability to damage not only Russia, but also its former sponsor who is not providing enough?
Well, I don't think that if we keep it within the question of, let's say, potential Ukrainian radicals, will they do anything? Will they reach American shores? Most likely not. I mean, I can't make, you know, absolute predictions, but they can very well reach American assets around the world. But for the time being, the only way for that scenario to happen would be if NATO, the EU, and all promises for getting into, you know, Borrell's European garden are shut, mm-hmm. and they realize that this was all a ruse. If Ukraine realizes that the only countries in Europe that benefit NATO-wise is Sweden and Finland. I mean, you got to think about this. You know, Ukraine is the one where the war is happening, and Sweden and Finland have been sitting by neutral, and they just join NATO like that. No problem whatsoever. And Ukraine is the one doing all the fighting. It has to dawn on many of them. In fact, when the war first began, I remember this back in, I think, March or April of 2022, Zelensky was quite angry, quite adamant in his insistence with NATO and other European countries, saying, look, give us an up or down answer. Are we in? Are we not? Are we something to you, or are you just going to use us as a pawn? Because if you're just going to use us as a pawn, look, just, you know, cut the nonsense. Tell me right now so we can cut a deal with Putin and save what can be saved.
I asked you before whether Washington has to be concerned about Ukraine's ability to deliver damage. And I want to throw in one potential example, because we started talking in the first part about the invasion or incursion into the Kursk region. And I've seen in some Ukrainian media speculate that one of the objectives of that raid was to get the nuclear power plant in Kursk and use it as a trump card in potential negotiations with Russia. First of all, let me ask you whether you think that was a realistic strategy or yet another of these grandiose fantasies that the Ukrainian leadership is so proud of.
My gut reaction to that is I have to go with the latter than the former. If they really had any plans on taking Kursk nuclear power plant, they would have planned this much better, and there would have been much more resources thrown into this. It could have been something that they said as a way of trying to justify what had happened. And if there was that window of opportunity, it passed. It's gone.
Now, at the same time, it's been voiced as a legitimate target, and we have had a number of examples of Ukrainian forces shelling various nuclear facilities. I've heard the number of experts raising concerns that nuclear targets are sort of becoming legitimized because it is being used by a nation state that is fully supported by the West. Are you concerned about that sort of aspect of the problem, that facilities that were previously off limit in national warfares are now considered legitimate?
I mean, look, you hit a nuclear power plant, I mean, we're all dead. And this is something that, at the end of the day, all but the most diehard war hawkish leaders in the UK and the US will say, this is a red line. You know, we don't want a Chernobyl. We don't, or more to the point, we simply do not want to give Russia a green light to retaliate, right? We were hearing up until about a week ago the talk about whether the US and the UK was going to lift the restrictions on Ukraine to launch larger missiles with more longer range, deeper into Russian territory, maybe even hitting Moscow, St. Petersburg, among others. And Putin's response, very, very simple response that he gave to Pavel Soruvin, was, if this happens, we know that this was given on orders from NATO, that this is NATO's approval. We no longer see Ukraine as the culprit in all of this. If they're doing this, NATO was the one that gave the order. We consider NATO to now be responsible and directly engaged in the war. And suddenly the US and the UK decide they're going to take a step back on all of this. So, you know, red lines are being drawn. Some are saying Putin is bluffing. Putin is, in a way, saying, try me. You know, try me. You really want to go that far? I mean, come to your senses.
Well, I think Putin's response was very measured, but at the same time, there is a very heated discussion here in Moscow that somehow the Kremlin needs to drive the message home to Western powers that their supplying of Ukraine with long-range striking capability will have certain limits and consequences. Mm-hmm. If Russia were to strike beyond Ukraine, and I'm sure you wouldn't want that to happen, but let's imagine this hypothetical. If Russia were to strike beyond Ukraine, where do you think that would be?
Depending upon where they strike. And they would have to, again, this is all hypothetics here. I mean, if they strike beyond Ukraine, but let's say that they do strike, let's say, you know, a NATO military installation, a naval installation. This is going to cause a major uproar within NATO between those that want to sue for peace because they don't have the capability or the stomach to bring to escalate the conflict. And look, there are a number of hawkish NATO countries, Poland, the Baltic states, potentially even Finland, that are going to say, let's do this. And that might cause an internal rift. NATO is having a very difficult time trying to find consensus. They're having a very difficult time even now trying to get some of their countries to commit towards, armaments lending. I mean, even within the European Union, you have countries like Slovakia and Hungary that are openly saying that we will not embargo Russian gas. We will not accept Ukrainian grain because it hurts our own economies. We're already beginning to see the cracks. We're beginning to see the ruptures within this supposedly united coalition. So, God forbid Putin should be forced to retaliate outside of Ukraine. It would be a very, very come to heart moment with NATO on how to respond.
Well, Professor Rossi, I hope your concern about that is heeded in some Western capitals. We'll have to wait and see. But for the time being, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you again.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.